Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's easy to tell the villain in an old Western. The good guy wears a white hat. The bad guy wears black. Real-life villains do not follow that code. We do have the cartoonish image of Snidely Whiplash twirling his mustache with poor Nell tied to the train tracks. But little on the nature, the true nature, of villainy. And why is our culture so absorbed with anti-heroes anyway? Chuck Klosterman is the New York Times ethicist. We spoke to him last year when his book, I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined, first came out. The essay collection is now available in paperback. When we spoke, I asked him how he came to define villainy for the purposes of his book.
First of all, when you're trying to write a book like this, when you're kind of working through ideas that are very conceptual, you're always looking for like a unifying field theory. And the closest I come is this idea that the villain is the person who knows the most and cares the least. Now, this is not perfect. There are certainly exceptions to this, some very meaningful. I mean, Hitler is a meaningful exception. Hitler is not someone who knew the most and cared the least. He cared about everything and didn't know anything. But for the most part, you know, what really bothers people is the idea of somebody who just has no emotional investment in what they're doing and yet is sort of effortlessly skilled at manipulating people or sort of controlling society or attaining whatever success that they want. I saw a documentary the other night on Lee Atwater.
Uh-huh.
I really wished I'd written about him because he's almost a perfect example of this. You know, he's this guy who was the architect of the Republican Party through the 70s and 80s and early 90s, did a lot of sort of diabolical things.
He was the Willie – he came up with the Willie Horton campaign, right?
He came up with the Willie Horton campaign. He would sometimes just blatantly lie about people's like – past mental illness or whatnot, you know, a lot of problematic things that within the context of politics were not only acceptable but very successful. But the most interesting thing about this guy to me is that he became a Republican arbitrarily. When he was a young man, he knew he was interested in politics and just saw more traction on the conservative side of the spectrum. If it had been reversed, if the nature of America had been different, he would have become, you know, a Democrat. And to me, that's like the ultimate manifestation of this kind of theory, the idea that this person who understood politics so well, he knew he could succeed and yet had no interest in really being engaged what that success meant.
And they're the people with the kind of swagger. I mean, Lee Atwater is a really great example of it. There's a kind of cynicism in choosing sides just based on what he thinks he can get out of it. And there's a special attention that you pay to those who aspire to villainy, the Aleister Crowleys, and the late 1980s hip-hop band N.W.A., whose real name and most famous song we can't say on the radio.
You know, there is a difference, though, between like an Aleister Crowley character and N.W.A. The fact of the matter is Aleister Crowley actually believed he had to do all these evil things in order to, I guess, be authentically villainous. Like, you know, when he was a young boy, he once killed a cat in 9 different ways, the same cat, just to test the theory of does a cat really have 9 lives? You know, he believed he had to eat all the drugs. He believed he had to push his mother-in-law down a flight of stairs because she represented this idea, this concept that he had to be against. What's different with N.W.A. or, say, the Oakland Raiders of the 1970s or perhaps even someone like Andrew Dice Clay is that they aspired to have the perception of villainy. They saw the kind of the utility in being against whatever the culture was. It's, you know, it's very strange because when someone is a villain on purpose, people don't really believe them. They see it more like a theatrical move.
It works in some places, I guess, in others. And that's one of the things I kind of took away from this book, that a Muhammad Ali, for example, he comes away as the sort of beloved character, while Joe Frazier, who worked himself up from, what, the cotton field, becomes the despised one. Why so fickle?
Well, you know, it's really like a good question. Can I totally explain it? I can't, but I find it very fascinating. I find it fascinating that Muhammad Ali, during his kind of 3 defining fights against Frazier, used incredible racist language against Frazier and basically positioned him as a black fighter fighting for white America. With Ali, it's particularly complicated because outside of this window, he's probably the most important athlete of the 20th century in terms of race relations. So then it becomes a question of, are we trying to look at someone in totality and trying to go, well, okay, most of what they did was good. They did this one terrible thing. Can we excuse that? But it goes further with figures who are sort of this towering in the culture. Muhammad Ali, I almost compare a little bit to John Lennon. John Lennon has a real problematic history with women. I mean, his own kids have talked about remembering John Lennon hitting his wives, you know. But as a Beatles fan, and I'm one of these people, it's almost like we don't want that to even be part of the story. You know, with Ali, I think part of it had to do with his pure confidence, sort of his unadulterated bravado that forced those around him to sort of accept that, well, he's a progressive no matter what he says. You know, no matter what the message seems to be content-wise, we know as a figure he is the progressive. And over time, the progressives always succeed because, you know, the culture evolves too. And anybody with progressive ideas, no matter how strange they may seem at the time, are eventually going to seem completely valid.
Chuck Klosterman is with us, and he's talking about his new collection of essays called I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. Well, not to mention that Muhammad Ali is an attractive man, and there is something that you point out here that a lot of Bernard Goetz, for example, who was for about 5 minutes, you know, a hero, the subway vigilante who shot 4 youths on a subway train in New York in the 1970s, doesn't make out so well, being a weird-looking guy. Linda Tripp, obviously, doesn't make out so well, not being a very attractive person, through no fault of her own. But how much do looks have to do with the perceived villainy?
Well, you know, I'm probably especially sensitive to this because I'm a very weird-looking person. And I think that if you're a weird-looking person, the understanding of how much handsomeness and sexuality plays in interpersonal culture is really maybe amplified. I have an essay in this book where I'm talking about the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky situation. Mm-hmm. And it would be very easy, I think, to say like, well, you know, why was Bill Clinton able to sort of have this event happen in his life, basically be the world's most famous philanderer for a period of time? He really, you know, in a weird way, put the presidency at risk for this kind of one desire that he, again, had no emotional investment in. And of course, the first response somebody will have to that is, well, you know, that's just this double standard we have that men can get away with this and women can't, you know. And there's certainly some truth in that, but the attractiveness of Bill Clinton was a role in this as well. I don't think Nixon would be allowed to have had that kind of experience and been re-embraced not just by America as a whole, but specifically by women. That Christmas, he had the highest approval rating of his entire tenure as president.
Well, in addition to being a slightly weird looking, or let's just say a person who didn't care very much about his appearance, I'm going back to Bernard Goetz, just because he talked. He filled himself out as a person. He let us know who he was and what his motivations were, which really turned everybody off. And you make that point here. It's the people who talk. It's the Wilt Chamberlain who talks about himself. It's Linda Tripp who decides to talk about herself. Is it better just to stay silent, to keep a heroic kind of poise?
You know, the silence is part of it, certainly. But it's almost even a larger abstraction. It's the idea that people don't know anything about you, so they can fill you kind of with whatever their pre-existing desire happens to be. You know, Bernard Goetz shoots people on a subway. Okay, initially, if you go up to anyone who's intellectual, somebody who has, a supposedly sophisticated view of culture and say, like, is vigilante justice acceptable? They will say no. You know, of course not. We have a framework for this. People need due process. You cannot allow an individual to decide what justice is. But then you give them a situation without many details. All you know is that there's this person in a city filled with crime, bothering no one, confronted by 3 potential criminals, and he kind of responds with violence. When that's all the information we have, it almost seems like he is acting as an agent for society, or maybe that he's making, the world safer by, you know, shooting people in public. It seems paradoxical, but that's the initial sense of Bernard Goetz. The first 48 to 72 hours of those shootings, you really couldn't find anybody who had a problem with him. It was like he was an unknown hero. But once he comes forward and he says things like, I wanted to kill those guys. Shooting them was easier than typing. We start learning details about things he said at a community meeting that were potentially racist. We find these bizarre things about his life. For example, he still lives in New York in an apartment with squirrels in it because he's a big advocate for squirrels, you know. We learn all these sort of interesting details about him, but what that does is it makes his actions now seem personal. He no longer seems like he's an agent for society. He seems like an agent for himself. And that forces everyone to swing back to the original idea that you just can't let the lone gunman decide what is right and what is wrong.
You make the point in the book that we say thank you to the convenience store clerk so that we can be seen as the kind of people who say thank you, right? We're invested in people knowing what we like or dislike. So how much of the hero and the villain is a projection of how we want to be seen?
Oh, I think certainly almost all of it. This book is like all of my kind of essay collections. It's not as though I'm trying to persuade people to believe a certain thing about villains or heroes or anything. I'm not like that. I know that's kind of antithetical to criticism in some ways, but I have no desire to be like a tastemaker or to shape public opinion. I'm trying to explore these things on my own. Like something's interesting in my life. And I feel like the best way for me to kind of work through my consciousness is kind of through writing about it. So, you know, a lot of this book has to do with my own fear that I am a bad person regardless of what I do. So a lot of what I think about in this book is not even what happened, but why it happened to begin with. Like, what was the intent? And then how is that intent sort of manipulated by the audience?
Okay, so how about just a quick little quiz? I'm going to ask you who is more villain.
Okay.
Taylor Swift or Eazy-E?
Well, Eazy-E is trying to project the image of badness. It is a conscious construction. Taylor Swift is attempting to create the illusion of purity. I would say Taylor Swift is probably closer to an actual villain than Eazy-E.
Okay, Julian Assange or Darth Vader?
Well, Julian Assange is absolutely convinced that what he is doing is more moral than what the mainstream media does. He is very much a believer that if you put information out, even if it harms one person or 10 people or 100 people, there's a value to that if it ends up saving the lives or transforming the lives of a million people. Darth Vader blew up planets arbitrarily. So I guess Darth Vader is more of a villain.
My earlier conversation with Chuck Klosterman about his book of essays, I Wear the Black Hat, Grappling with Villains, Real and Imagined. The book is now available in paperback.